Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and I'm glad to have you listening on this Monday when we're focused on pandemic science and research. This hour, how to understand the effects of the variants on transmission, on vaccines, on the way we'll be living through the spring. If you heard Dr. Mike Osterholm last Thursday, you heard him comparing this moment of lower case counts and decreased mortality to watching the offshore approach of a Category 5 hurricane.
Imagine we're all sitting on this beautiful sand beach on the Gulf somewhere, blue skies, temperature of 80 degrees, light breeze, not a cloud in the sky. And we're trying to tell people, get ready to evacuate. And everyone is saying, why? This makes no sense. But we can see that Category 5 hurricane 400 miles south of the beach heading straight towards the beach. And that's what these variants represent right now.
We've also seen data and reporting on the different variants that are emerging, including a new one named for Bristol, England. How do they behave? Why? How good are vaccine manufacturers at responding to these different variant characteristics? So our guests, our scientists, your questions. I wonder what you're making of some of this conflicting information as you look at dropping case counts, you hear these warnings about variants. What questions come up for you about the information on vaccines and variants? By the way, are you still seeing some misinformation about vaccines? We heard Senator Klobuchar talking about that in the news break. Are you still hearing misinformation about the vaccines? 651-227-6000. This is an opportunity to get the highest quality information, medical information, scientific information about vaccinations. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Deborah Fuller is with us, a vaccinologist, professor of microbiology at the University of Washington's School of Medicine, and with us from Seattle. Dr. Fuller, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Angela Rasmussen is with us, a virologist and affiliate at Georgetown University Center for Global Health Science and Security. Also with us from Seattle, Dr. Rasmussen. Angela, because I've talked to you so many times, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me back, Carrie.
Angela, so we are still early in the vaccination rollout. I mean, we're definitely making progress. A lot of Americans have been vaccinated, but many, many, many more to come. Is the reducing case count and the reduction in hospitalizations, does it have any connection right now with how many people we vaccinated? Or is this something else?
Well, this is a really tricky question, and I'm not sure that anybody actually knows the answer to this definitively, but I think that it's probably a combination of a number of different things. People have not been socializing as much after the holidays, so people's behaviors have changed, and I'm glad to see that many people are still taking masking and distancing and these other exposure reduction methods very seriously. People are increasingly being vaccinated. And on top of that, we've also unfortunately just had a lot of people in many communities who've already had COVID-19 and probably have natural immunity to it. So I think it could be explained by a combination of all of those things. But really, the short answer is that nobody really knows for sure.
Dr. Fuller, I've heard analogies made to wood to burn. I think Dr. Osterholm talks about this. You know, the virus is always looking for more wood to burn. And it is coming up against what Angela just suggested is some people in some communities who are no longer susceptible to the virus. And that may be part of the reason that we are seeing these case counts drop. What's your view on this?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Angela said in terms of the possible reasons why we're seeing the decline. And the multiple different strategies that are occurring, including the targeted vaccination that was being done to first target the people who are most vulnerable to the disease, the elderly. Those were, if you want to call them wood to burn, were probably one of the primary ones who were the most susceptible. And so the decline that we're seeing, particularly in hospitalized cases, I think, you know, there's a good chance that the targeted vaccination is playing a role. You know, I was looking at actually a trajectory of previous pandemics like measles and polio, and what happened when vaccines were introduced back in those decades. When they did a similar sort of targeted vaccination of the groups that are most vulnerable, and the trajectory looks really quite similar to what we're starting to see with COVID-19. Yeah, it was quite interesting.
Let me take a call here from Joyce in Minneapolis. Hi, Joyce. Good to have you on the line. What are you curious about?
I am actually curious about convalescent plasma and the different variants. I just donated blood. I had COVID. Mm-hmm. I haven't got the results yet, but they're checking to see how much antibodies I have, and I don't know if they're checking for what variants or if convalescent plasma can help people with all of the variants or only if it's the same variant that you had.
Good question. Joyce, I'm just curious about what your experience with the disease was. Did you have a fairly mild case or a pretty serious case?
For COVID, I had a very mild case. I was sick for 6 weeks. But
okay, wow.
I never lost, I never trouble breathing, and I, you know, I didn't lose my sense of taste or smell, which I was really happy about, since eating is one of my few pleasures during this pandemic. I basically felt like I had the flu.
I'm glad you're well.
But I got better, I got worse, I got better, I got worse, you know. I was home the whole time, and I live alone, so it wasn't, you know. I thought for COVID, that's pretty mild.
I'm glad you're well, and it's a good question. And Angela, I'm going to put this one to you. Antibodies, convalescent plasma, and whether it is what we know about how effective it is against these different variants.
So this is a really tricky question, just because with convalescent plasma, every person who gets COVID is going to have a different repertoire of antibodies that they produce against the virus that they're infected with. So it's very difficult to say that one person's convalescent plasma is going to be better than another person's convalescent plasma at neutralizing any of the variants that might be circulating. And on top of that, unfortunately, we really don't have a very strong evidence base that shows that convalescent plasma is actually very effective, at least at treating severe COVID-19 patients. So it may be that there are enough problems with convalescent plasma in terms of the samples just being different from one person to the next, that it's not thought to be as effective as a treatment as some other types of antiviral products. We've had more success in clinical trials looking at corticosteroids and a drug called tocilizumab. For people who have severe COVID-19, monoclonal antibody cocktails have more efficacy in treating people who are caught early in their infection. But the bottom line to this is that I'm grateful for people who are donating convalescent plasma. We do need more studies on it, but we also need more studies on just better antiviral and therapeutic options for patients.
This is why it's so valuable to hear the way, you know, science is advancing on this, Angela, because I remember early on, it was all, you know, there were big headlines about convalescent plasma, and this was going to be really essential. It's valuable to have, you know, insight on now what do we know about that, you know, 5 months later, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this really goes to show the importance of doing evidence-based science. Over the weekend, I actually gave a seminar in which one of the other presenters was the head of a Society for Critical Care Medicine, and he actually presented the entire evidence base for the use of convalescent plasma.
Wow.
And that's actually where I got the information
yeah.
that I just told you. So that really is the latest, and it is based on all these studies that have been done. It's really wonderful to see that type of science-based medicine occurring in action.
Deborah Fuller, I want to ask you about variants here, because we know that there is this UK variant, the Brazilian variant, a number of other, this Bristol variant emerged. Here's my question. is it likely that there are other variants circulating around the world, in our country, perhaps in Europe, that just haven't been surveilled and identified? Because that's kind of how this virus works.
Absolutely. The virus, as long as it's undergoing high levels of replication, there are reservoirs for it to be replicating. As long as we don't have worldwide immunity, that virus is still going to undergo mutations. And this is why the vaccination campaign, getting people vaccinated as soon as possible, is so important to build that immunity and reduce the number of reservoirs that allows that virus to generate these mutations. So it's sort of a race between vaccine and the virus. And if the vaccine can get ahead of the virus in terms of inducing immunity, we can begin to slow down its options for being able to replicate and develop new mutations that could potentially even in the future evade the vaccine-induced immunity. So we're sort of in a bit of a race, and I think it's really important that we both track the new variants that are coming out at the same time as uptick our vaccination rates.
Yeah, Deborah Fuller is with us. If you've just gotten in on the show, you know on Mondays and many other days, we talk about pandemic science and research. She is a vaccinologist and a professor of microbiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And Angela Rasmussen, a familiar voice. We're grateful for that. She's a virologist at an affiliate at Georgetown's University Center for Global Health Science and Security. We are talking this morning about what science is understanding about the emergence of these variants, how we should understand how the vaccines are working against the variants and the virus. I want to ask our guests what some of the vaccine manufacturers are doing to adjust for these variants. And then how should we interpret these dramatic case count reductions? This is such good news. I looked at the chart that the New York Times puts on the front page this morning and thought, this really looks like a light at the end of the tunnel. Well, you hear some infectious disease experts like Dr. Mike Osterholm who are much more concerned about what lies ahead in the next 60 days. What do you want to know about that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, Twitter at CarrieNPR, to Tom in Edina. Hi, Tom. Hey, Tom, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can. Go right ahead.
Good. Quick question. Thank you for taking my call. I'm scheduled to get my second dose of the Moderna vaccine this week, and I'm beginning to hear in some of the national news reports that it may only be lasting 4 or 5 months. The variants are impacting the long-term efficacy, and I also am hearing from some of the national sources like CNN and MS, at least the possibility of needing a third dose.
Oh.
And I wonder if your experts could maybe speak to that.
Dr. Fuller, you're the vaccinologist here. What would you say?
Yeah, so the evidence so far, right now, we really don't know how durable the vaccines are after you get your second immunization. But certainly we do know that the two doses are really important to be able to get the most durable immunity. The reason why we don't know is just simply because these vaccines have been out for less than a year. So we only have 4 to 5 months of data in the population to really monitor that. With that said, the data that I have seen shows that the antibody titers, even at 4 months post second immunization, are fairly durable. They're hanging up there pretty high. And so the expectation is it's likely to last longer than that. There is new data where they're looking at the immunity after a single immunization and ended up finding that there is some immunity even after the first dose, but we don't know how long that lasts. That they've only studied it for 28 days after the first dose. And we do know from other vaccines that the most potent immune response and the most durable response is going to occur after you get the second immunization. So in terms of durability, it's still a question out there how long that lasts. But and possibility of a third dose? Well, that's something that's being considered, particularly with the emergence of the new variants, where they are have found that the vaccines, particularly against the South Africa strain, are slightly less effective in terms of protecting from mild disease. But they have found that even with the most concerning variants, including the South Africa strain, is that the vaccines appear to protect from severe disease, protect you from going in the hospital. And I think it's really important that people understand that there's a spectrum of protection from a vaccine, from completely preventing infection to preventing any signs of disease to protecting you from being in the hospital and death. And this is a case for every sort of vaccine. So when people tell me they took a vaccine and, hey, I still kind of got sick, so it didn't work, that's not true. Mm-hmm. It probably protected you from actually getting really severe disease.
Yeah, Angela, Mark tweets, the Worldometer shows the 7-day average death counts dropping below 2,000 a day, and we all seem to be breathing a sigh of relief as we make plans to reopen. When did we stop caring about losing almost 2,000 people a day? And with that Category 5 coming, how many more people are going to die? First, I should say, Angela, what's your view of what Dr. Osterholm and some others are saying about what these variants are going to do in March and early April?
Well, I generally agree with Dr. Osterholm that right now is a time that we need to be very cautious. We do need to be looking at the horizon, at the storm that's potentially coming in. I don't know that I agree that for sure it's going to be the viral equivalent of a Category 5 hurricane. But without question, we definitely, this is not a time for us to be complacent. And that's why I've been trying to communicate to people that right now is the time that we really do need to hang in there with doubling down on our exposure reduction methods. So masking, distancing, still avoiding gatherings until we can get more of the population immunized. Because the variants won't be able to establish a foothold here. They won't be able to become prevalent if there's not as much viral transmission occurring, period. And the way to do that ultimately is through vaccination. But in the meantime, right now, the way to do that is by reducing opportunities for the virus to transmit to new hosts, which in this case are other people. So I'm very concerned. I think that it could be potentially really bad. I think, though, that if we do the right things now, we can really mitigate that danger.
You know, it's such a, I hear you loud and clear on this, but I find myself slipping into, you know, just this feeling like, oh, we've endured a year. The numbers finally look good. Do I really have to be as strict as I've been? Yeah, see, it's a contradictory kind of message, isn't it?
Boy, I feel you there, Carrie. Nobody is more tired of the pandemic, I think, than myself and my colleagues who I yearn for the day that I can go to the grocery store without thinking twice about it. I yearn for the day that I don't have any reporters calling me wanting to talk about COVID-19. I just yearn for the day that I won't be thinking about this virus at all. But we are not there yet, unfortunately. And I realize how tempting it is. I mean, I'm very tempted too to say, okay, the worst of it is behind us, but that may not be the case. And if we don't want even darker days to come, we really do need to just hang in there a little bit longer.
Call here from PJ in Maplewood. Hi, thanks for waiting. Your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if this is going to become like the flu long term, and so we may go in and get our flu shot and our COVID shot every year for years to come.
Yeah, good question, Dr. Fuller. I think to you on that, is it something that we will have to manage for years to come with vaccinations?
Yeah, there's a high expectation among scientists that this virus will likely become endemic. So after, of course, it stops being pandemic, endemic means that it's just in our population and circulating in a very similar fashion that we see the influenza virus circulating in our population. With that said, the expectation is also that even as it becomes endemic and as we build up immunity through vaccination, that it's not going to be as big of a burden as we're seeing currently, and that we would be able to manage it as we do with influenza at a manageable level. Not saying that influenza is something to sneeze at. It still causes a lot of deaths per year, but it's something that we manage over the course of the year. So there is some expectation of that, and the vaccine makers are preparing for that possibility by anticipating the likelihood that they may need to update vaccines to match the new variants, just as in the similar way that we do with influenza every year. So, but that's, in my mind, that would be a good thing. I mean, that's a good state to be in, is to have a situation where an infectious disease is under control, and that we have vaccines available to take each year to manage and control that and prevent the worst of it.
Dr. Fuller, I wonder if you think we are doing enough surveillance and sequencing of these variants. I know Britain has gotten some pretty high marks, even though the variant really created some serious case counts there. They get pretty high marks for being able to track it. I don't think we do as much of that here, do we?
No, we don't. I think that the rate that we actually sequence is around 1.5%, and that's compared to about 10 to 11% of the variants of people. It's a huge difference between the UK and the United States. And I know there's a concerted effort to try to uptick that. The other issue is that while there's a lot of spotty labs all over the nation that are sequencing, they're not as interconnected as they could be in terms of sharing that data and getting the information across to everybody. So I think that's a big issue that the United States needs to improve. I've heard it kind of similar, like we're sort of building the plane as we're flying it, in a sense, so that it's in progress, but it's still far behind other countries like the UK.
And Angela, let me ask you, do you believe that, because I know we talked about this with you a number of times, are we doing enough testing? I know it's easier to get a test, but are enough people getting tests for us to understand how the virus is still spreading along with the variants?
You know, we've never been doing enough testing, although that is a little bit different than genomic surveillance that we were just talking about. We've really never done enough testing. And, you know, there has been a persistent controversy about the availability of rapid tests that people could potentially do at home. And that might be something that we really do need to consider, not just for this pandemic as we sort of wind it down, but in terms of our preparedness plans. We do need ways to be able to get testing out to everybody and make it accessible for people for future epidemics or pandemics. And I think that this really needs to be, we need to take a good hard look at what we've done in the area of testing, because we've really never had enough.
So do you have a framework for when, as a, you know, as a citizen, you should get tested? I mean, is it a sense of, I've been exposed, I was in a place where then I learned that somebody, you know, was diagnosed with the virus? How do you decide as an individual that you should get tested?
Well, if I was notified by a contact tracer, or if I knew that I had been in an environment with somebody who ended up testing positive, then I would also seek a test and I would quarantine in the meantime. I've effectively been quarantining for the last 12 months, though. So I haven't had much cause to actually go get a test. I did have a test before going back to work at my old position at Columbia University. And that is really the only time that I've been tested. But again, I haven't been exposed to very many other people outside my household. I think that if people are going to work, for example, if they have to work in person, if they're essential workers, it's not a bad idea to seek a test periodically if that's available to you. It's unfortunately not available to many people. So that's why I think another reason why people often don't go out and get tested. People are not going to get tested if they have to pay for it. They're certainly not going to get tested regularly if they don't feel sick, if they don't know that they've been exposed. Again, if it's a significant cost to them or if it's very difficult for them to access testing.
Call here from Pete in Minnetonka. Hi, Pete.
Hey, good morning. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, my question is a little bit to the side of what you're talking about, but I think germane nonetheless, in that I was listening to some content or Dr. Fauci go through some statistics, and he said kind of an unrecognized statistic is the significant reduction in influenza cases and ultimately deaths over the course of the since the pandemic has begun. And he said, really, he said that's an outcome of the things that we've always suggested people do, which is just kind of, you know, be hygienic, right? Wash your hands. You know, if you're feeling ill, try to cover your face, all those little, you know, disciplines that we do now for the pandemic.
Right.
And he said it's proving itself out kind of a, he said, I don't mean to chalk this up as a win, but he said, nonetheless, he said that is positive. So my question to your experts is, do they see going forward coming out of the pandemic that maybe there's a better recognition by the masses that that's a, those are disciplines more worthy of sustaining, right? So that we can maybe curb the future event or spread of, you know, disease
yeah,
or pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, really good question. Angela, no, that's good. Angela, I'm going to put this to you, an ad that I was listening to Dr. William Schaffner out of Vanderbilt say that the reason we've had such a low flu season is because kids have been masked and they're not spreading it the way they usually do. So what can we take from this? And then what Pete's asking about our procedures going forward.
Well, I think we can certainly learn a number of lessons about how to stop the spread of epidemic infectious disease from this pandemic. One of those might be that during flu season, we should be adding more of these non-pharmaceutical interventions to our toolkit for preventing influenza. And that is not only things like masking and distancing and staying home if you're sick. I don't think that every flu season we're going to suddenly be all staying home and working from home all the time in the future. But I do think that we should consider adding more of these interventions, at least for people who are symptomatic or people who are at very high risk or who are in high-risk environments, potentially teachers, potentially kids. But we should also be thinking about policy solutions that make it easier for people to stay home if they're sick, for example, such as paid sick leave, making sure that people can enact some of these interventions during flu season. I think that could actually do a lot to prevent the spread of influenza every season.
It's a good idea, especially maybe with kids, right? I mean, if you've got a child who has a mild case of the flu, you're worried about them missing school, maybe distance learning for a few days, right? So they're not in that environment spreading it around. What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. And also making it possible for their parents to take time off work,
right,
and not risk their jobs or their livelihoods so that they can take care of their kids and
right,
so that they can take care of themselves.
Might be a whole new world. We'll see. Dr. Angela Rasmussen is with us, a virologist and affiliate at Georgetown University's Center for Global Health Science and Security. Dr. Deborah Fuller with us, a vaccinologist and professor of microbiology at the University of Washington's School of Medicine. We're talking about vaccines, accessibility, some of what the manufacturers are doing to adjust for these variants, how the variants are spreading. Taking in some of what Dr. Osterholm said on Thursday about this, and then how we should think about the next 60 days and then beyond that with managing this coronavirus. Taking your questions too, 651-227-6000 to Julie in Minneapolis. Julie, sounds like you have a question about the vaccines. Is that right?
Yeah. I was curious, since the Moderna and Pfizer give 80% coverage with a single dose, and Johnson & Johnson, they're saying about 70%. Why wouldn't it be useful to just get a single dose of the Pfizer or Moderna, which should still give you about an 80% coverage since durability is unknown, and then wait it out and see if there's a modified booster that comes out, say, by summer, and get that rather than the second dose of the first two?
Really great question. Dr. Fuller, where are you on moving away from the double dose to the single dose until more people get the vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. The current strategy is really to get at least a single dose in as many people as possible. But there's still a recommendation that you get that second dose as soon as possible. So the studies so far have shown that 80% efficacy is really very limited to date for the first, for just 12 to 28 days after you've got the immunization. That's where the studies end. They don't follow or track that beyond that. So we do not know if after 28 days after getting that single dose, how effective that dose is going to be. So it's very important to get that second dose. We know from classic vaccinology that that first dose, which is called a priming dose, is going to induce a very modest antibody response, and that's going to wane quite quickly. Traditionally, that's what happens. It's the second dose that gives you the highest level of antibody and the most persistent level of antibody. So it's still going to be important for everybody to get that second dose as soon as they can. With that said, getting that first dose in as many arms as possible is helping to expand the number of people that get immunized. So what happens? We wait till? Do you want to wait till the summer to get an updated version? We have no idea how quickly that updated version is going to come out. And it's important to know that even with the particular version that we have right now, the emerging studies are showing that despite the fact that it's not as effective against the newest variants in terms of protecting you from infection or keeping you asymptomatic, it does protect from severe disease. So it's still very important to get that second dose. And then when the newest versions are offered for whatever variant happens to be circulating at the time, if it's recommended that you come back in for a third dose, and that might happen down the line. So, but I think it's really important to get your second dose as soon as you're offered it. But I would also like to add, don't worry if you don't get it right away at the recommended interval. A lot of people have been asking me about that.
Say, so oh, can I you get extend? My... Yeah.
Yeah, a bit. You yep. can. That's the way the immune system works. That first dose is going to induce a memory response. It's going to sit with you for a long time, months, even potentially years, so that when you actually get that second dose, you're going to respond just as well as if you had gotten it at the recommended time.
Good to know. Angela, I spotted something in Stat News last week by Helen Branswell, and I wanted to throw this at you. It's about the myth of good and bad vaccines. And I think with Johnson & Johnson coming online, this is going to pop up. The piece examines the concerns about the effectiveness of different vaccines between Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and Pfizer. And here's what it says. I worry that we're going to have that kind of consumer-driven, oh, is it Moderna? Great. Is it Johnson & Johnson? No, thank you. I'll wait, says Allison Butenheim, an associate professor of nursing and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. That's just going to delay getting to the coverage that we want to get to. I wonder if you're concerned that there, you know, that some people are going to be like, well, that Johnson & Johnson, not quite as effective as Moderna. I'm going to hang on for the Moderna.
Yeah, I think that that's a really big problem. There has been a perception that these percent efficacy figures as determined by the clinical trials mean that one vaccine is better than another. And that raises issues also of vaccine equity, that why is this community getting access to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is less good than the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines? And my position is that people need to keep in mind what these clinical trials were actually looking at. Those efficacy figures are based on the ability of these vaccines to protect against symptomatic COVID-19. However, the Johnson & Johnson trial had another secondary endpoint that is very important that people should keep in mind. That vaccine was 100% efficacious at preventing death from COVID-19. It was also very, very effective at keeping people out of the hospital. So while it may not prevent all as many cases of symptomatic COVID-19 as the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, it is still incredibly effective with essentially perfect efficacy at preventing mortality. So it is still a very good vaccine. And what I always tell people is that if I am offered the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because I haven't been vaccinated yet, mm-hmm. I would gladly take that mm-hmm. vaccine.
Yeah.
I would take any vaccine that I'm offered.
Again,
I just want to
emphasize what you said. I think this is so important. They protect against the disease being so severe that it kills you. All of them. Super important, right?
Incredibly important. I mean, really, that is one of the most important endpoints. And the reason that I think a lot of people are also confused, why didn't the clinical trials look at their ability to prevent infection? Why didn't they prevent their ability, or why didn't they look at death as the primary endpoint? Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because that would just take a lot longer to conduct a clinical trial where you're looking for either of those as the endpoint. So symptomatic COVID-19 of any severity was the primary endpoint in these clinical trials so that these vaccines could be authorized as soon as possible so that they would get enough information to be able to recommend these vaccines for the general public. And I think that a lot of this is really the sort of nuts and bolts of how clinical trials are designed, which most people are probably not thinking about all the time.
Right.
But as you said, you know, the important thing is these vaccines are very, very efficacious, all of them, at preventing hospitalization and death. And that's what people really should keep in mind. Also, to get to a caller's previous question about a third or additional vaccine booster doses, we may be in a situation where down the road, we are looking at what are called heterologous dosing regimens. So you get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, for example, at the beginning, and then you get a booster of Pfizer or Moderna or maybe Novavax, which is currently undergoing clinical trials right now. That would presumably increase efficacy even more if people were getting boosters down the road of the same vaccine they got previously or of a different vaccine. So people really should keep in mind that these vaccines, as they are now, are very effective at preventing death, but also down the road, they may be even more effective as we learn more about how to dose them.
Good. Call here from Stacy in Dayton, Minnesota. Hi, Stacy.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was wondering, so I was listening to one of your shows a few weeks back. I think it was a couple of experts of epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that there was, I don't know if it was the language they used, but a finite or a limited amount of mutations that the virus can take, and therefore it wouldn't necessarily take the same path as like the flu virus where we have to get a booster every year. And it sounds like that there, you know, the durability of these vaccines might be an issue here, but just curious if you guys could talk about that and which information is more correct, I guess.
Deborah Fuller, I don't remember our guest saying that there was a limit to the number of mutations that a virus can make. Maybe you can shed some light on this.
Yeah, I always learned in my virology class that if a virus can, it will, and that just simply means that a virus will find ways to evolve and evade immunity or gain additional advantage to itself. I think there is the question then comes, I think, is there a certain limited number of mutations that a virus can take? One of the things that we're working on is what I would call, it's called a second generation vaccine that is going to be designed to induce immune responses against parts of the virus that we think are absolutely essential for that virus to maintain its own fitness. The idea there is that in the future, we might have a vaccine that's able to protect not just against the current variants, but even future ones that emerge. And so the concept there is that could we impose enough pressure on the virus that it forces it into coming up with sort of a number of different mutations that compromise its own fitness. So there is some effort going on there, and there is ways that through vaccination we could potentially focus a response on particular regions of the virus and force it to actually end up mutating and compromising itself. So it's more precise, though. If you allow the virus just to evolve
randomly, it's going to try to evolve mutations that is going to be able to evade host immunity. But if you could potentially design a vaccine in the future that is able to precisely induce responses that constrain the virus and what it can actually, what mutations it can actually develop. So there's a little bit of both there.
Angela, let me ask you about schools here. We did an hour on this last week, and it caused a lot more questions. We're hearing about an outbreak of COVID cases in British Columbia at 7 different schools. They're elementary and middle schools, and it's this B117 variant. And they have quarantined the classes. They have kept the schools open. Schools are open in Canada. Schools are open in a lot of different places around the world. But as you know, there's a lot of concern about reopening schools in the United States. How do you feel about the news that we're sharing about the variant, the concern that you're seeing from teachers, and getting kids back to school? Have you come to some conclusions about that?
Gosh. yes,
it's a big
and
question.
No.
I know.
My take-home conclusion is that the issue is incredibly complicated, and I don't think there's one right answer. And I know that sounds like a bit of a dodge, but the data has been somewhat confusing about how readily SARS coronavirus 2 can spread in a classroom environment. And it's further complicated by the fact that a lot of schools have different mitigation measures in place. There are different levels of asymptomatic testing of students. So we are dealing with a lot of large gaps in data. I think that in some places, if appropriate mitigation measures are in place, and depending on the age of the students, for example, it's thought that primary schools or elementary schools are not as big of drivers of outbreaks as high schools, that schools could be opened safely. But that said, I think that it's completely reasonable for teachers to demand vaccination before going back into the classroom. Because we don't know exactly the risk of transmission in schools, and because for teachers who do become infected, it's very difficult to separate infections acquired at school versus infections acquired in the community, I think that it's completely reasonable for teachers to expect that they would have access to vaccines before going into the classroom to protect them.
Wow. I mean, this is, you know what the CDC is saying about this, right? Teachers don't need to be vaccinated before they go back to school.
The CDC is saying that, but the CDC also has put out a detailed set of guidelines for when it is safe to open schools at all. And I think that that's getting lost from this conversation, which is why it's such a complicated topic. The CDC is not saying open up all schools immediately. You'll get vaccinated when you get vaccinated to teachers. Mm-hmm. They're saying that if these mitigation measures are in place, and if there's this level of community transmission and testing positivity, then it may be safe to open schools. But ultimately, that decision is left up to local school officials and authorities. So this whole topic is extremely complicated. And again, there's no one right answer for this. Everybody has an opinion, but nobody's necessarily right.
Dr. Fuller, I'm getting a number of questions here on Twitter and emails about if I have had COVID, why do I need the vaccine? And if I need the vaccine, why can't I just get one shot?
Right. So that's a very good question. So there's a recent study that just came out in Nature Communications that shows what I actually kind of thought was going to happen, is that the vaccines induce much better immunity than COVID-19 getting exposed to the infection. So you get much, much stronger antibody responses, and it's much more durable than the antibody responses you get as a result of being exposed to COVID-19. So that alone is good reason to get the vaccine so that you can bump up your immunity and sustain that immunity. So the other question is, do I need to get both doses? So there are the evidence so far shows that if you'd been exposed to COVID-19, when they actually immunized people with their first dose, those individuals did make a stronger immune response than individuals who hadn't been exposed to COVID-19, in the sense that their antibody titers were were much higher after a single immunization. That makes sense to me too, because the infection would have acted as a priming immunization. So do you still need to get that second dose? Again, we don't know, however, whether getting primed by the virus and then boosted with the vaccine, how durable that's going to be. We do have a lot more information about two doses of the vaccine. So it's best to still get both of your doses. I do know that the recommendation is that if you were exposed to COVID-19, you wait 90 days before you get your first vaccine. And that's just really allowing the initial immune response to settle down and get that booster immunization before you get that booster immunization vaccine.
Dr. Fuller, much appreciate the time. Dr. Rasmussen, thank you. Good to talk to you again. We really are grateful for the time and the insight this morning. Dr. Deborah Fuller, a vaccinologist and professor of microbiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Angela Rasmussen with us, a virologist and affiliate of Georgetown University's Center for Global Health Science and Security. Coming up on Wednesday morning, we're going to take straight on Dr. Osterholm's concerns that we have a gathering Category 5 hurricane of COVID cases heading at us. Don't miss it. NPRnews.org.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!